Welcome to the Kensington Church Audiocast, where you can listen to live recorded teachings from our weekly Sunday services. We're glad you're here to listen in.
Beginning in Matthew 5, Jesus starts off this longest recorded teaching with these attitudes of what he desires for us as his followers to have. So they're the Beatitudes, like be this way in your attitude. And it's made up for us the last couple weeks of messages. Since Easter until now, when we're finishing this series today, we've been calling it Becoming. The whole idea that the more that we live out these attitudes, these attributes of who God is with his power, because you're not doing this on your own, that we will increasingly begin to look more and more like Jesus. I think many of us know this, but even the term Christian, you know, it means little Christ. The idea is that you and I should increasingly look more like Jesus. That when the world looks at us, when people look at us, when our neighbors look at us, when our family looks at us, what they see more and more is Jesus. And almost less and less us. That's why John in the Bible once said, "May I decrease that you would increase." The idea that we would become more like him. I mentioned this before, this isn't new. If you've been around, you know this, but I've got twin daughters, they're 17, probably the closest experience I've ever had to watching two people actually look like one another, like literally their whole lives. Matter of fact, even, I think it was a couple years ago, they informed me that they did not want to be referred to as the girls anymore, because this is what I call them. I was like, "Hey, girls." They're like, "Hey, I'm Jaws, and that's Core. We're two different people. We're not the same." But I was always just calling them girls. They have twin cousins that are also 17, girls, and they get referred to, their names are Sophie and Chloe. For the longest time, they've just been called Sof-Clo. Doesn't matter who it is. You're Sof-Clo, because nobody knows how to tell them apart. Like, that's kind of the idea. Matter of fact, just for fun, I got a couple of pictures, because this is what, when Jesus says, "Look more like me," like, this is one of my earliest favorite pictures. Nope, that's not looking in a mirror. That's both of them. Come on, that's adorable. Come on. If you don't love my kids, I don't love you, and I'm going to leave, okay? That's number two, this is one of my favorite, because their whole life, they've just like spontaneously done things at the same time, at the same moment. Like, these are two human beings that have grown up looking alike. You're totally different people. I get all of that. One of you has a really sloppy room and the other a really clean one. But you're totally different people, but they look alike. And that's part of the idea, that as we take on the attitude, the attributes of Jesus, that we would do so in a way that makes us begin to look more like him. And then we don't just look like him. We actually begin to access more of who he is and more of what he has. Matter of fact, funny, really quick, last one. I'm sorry. Can I tell a story about you guys real quick? I can. Oh, that's very nice of you. Thank you. So my daughters, as they've gotten older, the look-alike that they have has been more than to the benefit of just cute pictures. They'll go to the store. They'll come home. This is a regular argument in our home. "Hey, you still owe me $8. No, I gave you back your $8. No, you didn't give me $8. So they're always arguing because they loan each other money and they're at the store and one forgot their cash. So the other day, my one daughter is on my other daughter's phone. And my daughter, Jazza, goes, "What are you doing on my phone?" She's like, "You still owe me money. You haven't paid me back." She's like, "Well, why do you have my phone?" She's like, "Because your bank app recognizes my face as yours and I just deposited money out of your account into mine." True story. Yeah, better change that somehow. That's a fail, Apple. But that's part of the idea, is that as we become more like Christ, like, we will look like him, and then we have greater access even to his resources and his kingdom. I was in a conversation a couple years ago with actually a group of pastors here from Kensington, trying to figure out, like, what does a disciple of Jesus look like? And then the conversation shifted at one point to, what does a disciple of Kensington look like? And then there was this idea that got thrown around the room that anywhere we go in the world, people should be so reflective of Kensington that they would be recognized. If you go to Europe, you go to Japan, you go to anywhere in the world, you would be recognized as a disciple of Kensington because you look so much like Kensington. And I remember thrown into the conversation, I'm like, "Yeah, that's what we call a cult, actually." Wherever we go in the world, we should look like Jesus because we represent Jesus. And that's the idea of this whole series, that we would become increasingly like him. Because if Jesus is the archetype of Christianity, then I think in many ways, the Beatitudes are the blueprint of part how we begin to move in that direction to actually look like him. So I just want to pray for a minute, ask him to speak, be clear. I think he has been all the way up till I got here this morning on stage. So just going to ask God to keep doing his work this morning. Father, I come before you right now and just acknowledge the words that we sang, the words that we've heard even in scripture read, Jesus, they are about you, and we want to lift you up above all things. And so, God, I pray that you would meet with us this morning to do your good work of being disruptive in our lives, disruptive in our hearts, to the good end of shaking us out of maybe our comfort, shaking us out of the places that would have us to be maybe apathetic to you or even to be numb to you. God, just bring us to a place of life this morning. Awareness of you, awareness of what it is you long to say to us, the things that we'll want to cling hold of and the things that maybe we're not sure how to cling hold of. So God, would you do what only you can do? Nobody from this stage can fully and appropriately and accurately represent you and teach your scriptures. So would you do that, Holy Spirit, in a way that only you can do in very personal, intimate, and detailed ways to each and every one of us listening today? And I pray this and I ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. So we're going to take up our offering before we go any further. Let me say this real quick about our offering. Every week we take up offering. This is a part of who we are as a community. And I always try to figure out a way to explain why we do and what we do. I want to tell you this about offering really quick. I don't personally care if you give. You're like, what? Here's what I care about more than whether or not you give in this moment. There is a God who has given us all that we have. Scripture's clear that every good and perfect thing comes from above. And part of the opportunity that we have, not the shame, not the compulsion, not that you should so, part of the opportunity that we have is to open back our hands with what God has given us. Whether you do that here, or whether you do that somewhere else, whether you give to another church, here's what I want more than anything else. I want you to deeply, truly believe that God has been so good to you that everything you have is of his good graces, and then you want out of joy, not compulsion, you want to give back to the kingdom work of letting other people know that he loves them. And I hope you want to do that here. If you want to do that here, great. But at the end of the day, my greatest desire isn't that you give money here. My greatest desire is that you let your ear be tuned to the will of God for your life, and you go, what do you want me to do, God? And if it's here, do it. If it's somewhere else, do it. My greatest desire is that God speaks, you'll listen, and you'll do what he says, because I'm telling you, in that place, you will experience more of what he has for you in partnership with his kingdom moving forward than just doing it because it's routine, rhythm, or out of some sense of weird compulsion because you have to. But for those of you that do it here, well, they're not on the screen anymore. It was on the screen. Hopefully you took note and all the buckets went by. So for those of you that do give here, thank you so much. All right, so I do want to give a little bit of a quick disclaimer to this morning, especially after first service. We're going to talk about the final attribute of the Beatitudes today that Jesus lays down for us. We've been looking at all of them throughout the last couple of weeks. This morning we're going to look at peacemaking. I think that peacemaking of the other attributes and the other Beatitudes is one that so often we can have a polarized misunderstanding of what it means. And I just want you to know, right now, I'm going to just warn you about this. I will say things today that some of you are going to disagree with. I'm going to say things today that some of you are going to agree with. I'm going to say things today that might force you to have to rethink a little bit of what it means to be a peacemaker, of what it means to even follow in Jesus' example and footsteps as a peacemaker. So here's what I want to preemptively ask you right now. If I say things this morning that offend you, frustrate you, or even make you angry, sit in it. Like, let it be a little disruptive to you. And ask yourself, is there something there that maybe is rubbing against something that I need to? Frictions create tractions. Is there something here that I actually need to let be disruptive for me this morning? And maybe there's not, but if there is, I would just say, sit in that for a moment. Because if you come here every single week and all you ever feel is good about everything that I say, then I'm probably not saying things true enough. So I hope that there are times where you're like, yeah, I don't know if I like that. That's great, good, sit in it. I might be wrong, but let's sit in it together and let's God do some of what I think he does best when he disrupts us a little bit and kind of agitates us. It makes us go, I don't know if I like that, and I don't know if I believe that. So if that happens, will you just stay with me in it? Will you sit with me in it? And at the end, let's have a conversation. And if we can't have it today, I'll give you my phone number. You're welcome to call me. We'll have lunch. I'm not trying to say we can't. I want to talk about anything that may disrupt you. Some of you are like, what is he going to say? Probably building this up more than I need to. But I just know when we talk about peacekeeping, this is something that we can very easily and very wildly misunderstand and very opposite ends of the spectrum. And I'm just asking, if God disrupts us a little bit today, let's just sit in that disruption and see how it is that he might lead us to better understand, not what I want us to understand, but what he may want us to understand. Deal? All right, last couple of weeks, as we've looked at the Beatitudes, we have seen that the Beatitudes, go to Matthew 5, we can see them. The Beatitudes have covered things like being poor in spirit, those who mourn, so you have empathy towards other people, the meek, the merciful, those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. So we get to the end of the list, Matthew chapter 5, verse 9, and this is the last one that Jesus puts into his teaching. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. Now, one of the things that's interesting is right off the bat, there's a distinction between this last attribute, beatitude, and the rest of them in this, is that the rest of them are followed by a sort of a gift, if you will, in response to them being lived out. So, for example, blessed are the poor in spirit, theirs is the kingdom of heaven. They get the kingdom of heaven. If you go on, blessed are those who mourn, they get comfort. Blessed are those who are meek, they inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, they will be filled. Blessed are the merciful, they will be shown mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. So you get a lot of kind of reward as you live out this way. You get filled, you get satisfied. You even get to see God. Like there's this extra way you're seeing God, experiencing God. So there's something given in response to living this way out. It's just a cause and effect. Here's what's different about this beatitude. With this one, you're given an identity. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. This is the only beatitude that attributes an identity to the end of it and not merely a reward or a cause and effect. And I think maybe nothing identifies us more as followers of Jesus, as children of God, than a willingness to live out the peacemaking attitude of Jesus. I also think part of the challenge in this is that if we're honest with ourselves, our world and many of us for our personal lives know very little about true, honest peace, including and especially Christ-like peace. You go to the highest level of the lack of peace, it'd be war. And if we were to talk about war, and if I was to ask you, hey, how many wars since World War I? Somebody asked me that recently, and I started naming off all of like the wars of America. I'm like, well, there's Vietnam, there's Desert Storm, there's a war on terror, there's World War II. But if you go beyond just us, do you know since World War I till present day, there have been 260 major wars. Now that doesn't even acknowledge or account for the thousands of minor conflicts, minor uprisings. Like I'm talking major wars in which significant loss of life has happened. 260 from World War I till now. And then if you peel back from war, because that's kind of the extreme version of a lack of peace, let's just go to our country. Let's go to our relationships. I think we would all agree that for most of us, we've probably never lived in a time where our country has felt more divided and more polarized than it has been in the last number of years. Now, some people are like, it's never been. I might argue that the Civil War was a time where we were pretty divided. But in our lifetime, we've probably never lived in a more divided experience where we have vilified everybody. We criticize everybody. We condemn everybody. We cancel everybody. And we divide over everything. Politics, religion, race, socioeconomic. I mean, you fill in the blank. There is so much division. And you know as well as I do, a lot of it was only kind of gas on a fire 4 years ago in November, and it's going to be the same way again this year. And I pray that the followers of Jesus would do better this time around. Would actually ask, what does it look like this time around to be peacemakers in the way that he would have us to be? But we have division around the globe for generations. We have a lack of peace in our own country. How about even the cancel culture phenomenon? You know, one of the things that's interesting, we have a way of criticizing past generations for their absurdities. Take the Salem witch trials where we burn people at the stake. That's all cancel culture is. It's our modern day era Salem witch trials, where we determine somebody that's dangerous and we eliminate them. And then in our own personal lives, you know as well as I do that there is so often just lack of peace in our personal lives. For some of us, it's in our marriage. For some, it's in our families, maybe immediate, maybe extended. For some of you, it's in your neighborhood. It's at work. It's in your kids' sports. My girls play soccer, and good grief, we had a game on Friday, and I thought at one point it was like legit gonna turn to fist to fist. Like there was intensity. I'm like, what the heck? Even worse than when we played Grosse Pointe South, which that gets nuts too. But like this one was, who did we play? Dakota, that's right. And we beat them. So sorry if you're from Dakota. But it just got like super, like words get thrown back by parents. Even the kids on the field were getting along better than the parents were. I'm like, you guys, calm down. Like it just seems like there's this like just tender box everywhere we go, ready to go. Even at church. Like let's be honest. Some of you are at the 11 o'clock because you know who attends the 9 o'clock. Some of you are sitting on the left side of the room because you know who's sitting on the right side of the room. I mean, even here, we allow a lack of peace to create division between us. This last week, I had to have a sit down with a coworker who we had to admit to one another there has been a lack of peace between us for a little bit of time. And we had to talk about why that is. And both of us had to own some things that we probably didn't want to own, but we realized we needed to, and we worked through it. Got to the end, and I think it was much better. But we had to admit and we had to realize, like just even this last week, like even at church, people that work at church, like we were not displaying a lot of peace between us in some areas that we had to work through. Our world is full of no shortage of a lack of peace. And then when you consider the fact that our efforts so often to create peace, particularly when it's without the power of Jesus Christ, can lead us to one of two dangerous polar extremes. Like peace gone wrong on one extreme, it's cancel culture. It's where a small group of highly offended people determine that somebody is a threat to the larger group of society and we eliminate them. And then on the opposite end, we can, if we don't drift that way, where we can drift is just sticking our head in the sand and being passive about everything. And we believe that passivity and constant only gentleness, that's how we're peace. That's how we bring peace. And so most of the time, we'll just ignore things, not want to deal with it, head in the sand, passive. And as long as I'm not contributing into the situation, then what I am doing is I'm presenting peace. And I think if we're not careful, we can try to create peace, but we will, without the power of Jesus, we will automatically drift to polar ends that are more destructive sometimes. So let's give peace a definition. Peacemaker. Here's a biblical definition of a peacemaker on your screens. It is to live with selfless effort to seek the well-being of others. I encourage you even to take a picture of that. To live with selfless effort to seek the well-being of others. Now, this part of the Bible, Matthew, is written originally in the Greek language. And in the Greek language, this word that's translated into peacemaker, it's interesting because much of the emphasis in that phrase goes to the verb. Make, making, maker. In other words, here's what's so important, and here's where we can misunderstand what peacemaking means sometimes. We are not merely called to be peacekeepers. We're called to be peacemakers, and those aren't the same. As a matter of fact, even if you go back to the Old Testament, and this can get confusing real quick, so stay with me for a minute. If you go back to the Old Testament, the word for peace is the word shalom. Now, the word shalom is what's called a positive state word. That means that something has to be introduced in the word. There's an effort that is required of us in the concept being discussed, as opposed to a negative state, which means we don't introduce anything. So like a negative state would be, you know, it's raining outside. Okay, it's raining. Well, the positive state would be build a shelter that protects you from the rain. So this is a positive state word, not negative state. If it was negative state, here's what it would just mean. Peacemaker would just simply mean go find where peace exists and enjoy it. Benefit from it. Reap the rewards of it. But because it's a positive state word, it means that we're supposed to bring peace into situations that lack it. Meaning that true peacekeeping, as Christ would call us to be, that would make us look like children of God, that would make us look like Him, is an intentional, thoughtful effort. It's not just let's go find peace and let's just experience it. It means that we are called to actually bring peace into this world through our efforts, especially and particularly where it does not exist, is to move into places that lack peace and bring peace and be peace. In the book of Ephesians, the Apostle Paul writes to what at the time is a very young church in Ephesus. And in many ways, I think he's writing what could be described as the gold standard understanding of peace. Where it comes from, the consequences of its absence, and what it does accomplish. True peace, Christ's peace. Ephesians 2, if you got a Bible, love you to go there with me. If not, again, it's going to be on your screen. Ephesians 2, Paul writes this. Therefore, remember that formerly you who are Gentiles by birth and called uncircumcised by those who call themselves the circumcised, which is done by human hands. So real quick, I just want to point out what he's doing right now is he's pointing out that there is two groups of people that have a divide between them. The circumcised, the uncircumcised, Jews, Gentiles, basically Jews and everybody else that's not Jewish. The circumcision, uncircumcision obviously refers to a practice of the Jews, and the uncircumcised, it is a critical reference to those who are not participating in that practice. Part of what he is pointing out is that between these two groups of people, there is a divide, a lack of peace. This is not a new idea. This is not a radical idea. A lack of peace creates division between people, but it also creates division between us and God. Paul goes on and he says this, remember, at that same time, you were separate from Christ, excluded from citizenship in Israel, and foreigners to the covenant of the promise, without hope and without God in the world. But now, in Christ Jesus, you who were once far away have been brought near by the blood of Christ. So he says the lack of peace, it's going to create a problem between you, people, and it's going to create a problem between people and God. Here's a solution. For he himself, who's he? Jesus. Is our peace. He himself, peace is not just an elusive idea. It's not a concept out there. It's not an ethereal thing. It's a being. He says, Jesus is actually our peace. And how did he do that and what did he do? For he himself is our peace, who has made the two groups one and has destroyed the barrier and the dividing wall of hostility by setting aside in his flesh the law with its commandments and regulations. His purpose was to create in himself one new humanity out of the two, thus making peace. And in the one body, to reconcile both of them to God through the cross by which he put to death their hostility. He came and he preached to you who were far, and peace to those who were close. Consequently, you are no longer foreigners and strangers, but fellow citizens with God's people and also members of his household. So he says, listen, the lack of peace, because he is peace, and without him, there's division between people, there's division between us and God. But through his sacrifice, what he did is offer the opportunity for there to be peace and reuniting between us as intended to be and between us and God as he intended to be. And here's the result, not only the experience of peace, but adoption then into the family of God, where we're no longer divided by what he calls the wall of hostility, but now we become brothers and sisters. That's what peace does, and that's what the absence of peace also creates. So what does this look like for us as we go back into our regular week? Tomorrow you go to work, you go to school, you go to wherever we're gonna go tomorrow. Like, what does it look like as we move into the rest of today, the rest of the week, to be peacemakers? If God has destroyed what could be hostility between us, given us the opportunity to experience peace that is him and experience it with one another, what do we do? Like, how do we move into our world to actually be peacemakers? And I'll just tell you, I'm gonna give you a few things in a list. And every time I give a list, somebody inevitably will email me later on and go, you left these four things off the list. Listen, you don't wanna be here till 6 o'clock. I don't wanna be here till 6 o'clock. So I'm not gonna give you the full list. There's probably a much bigger list than I would even be creative enough to come up with without your help. But I'm gonna give you a few things that I think are fundamental. If we're gonna be the children of God, if we're gonna look like him, if we're gonna access the bank account of God, then I think part of what it means is to be a peacemaker. And if we're gonna be a peacemaker, here's the first and the most fundamental step that we've gotta take. You and I have to be regularly committed to pursue the Prince of Peace. You know, Jesus was given names to be called long before he was ever born. Back in the book of Isaiah, Mighty, Counselor, Everlasting God, and then what? Prince of Peace, the Prince of Peace. You and I cannot bring the peace of God into this world without experiencing the peace of God on the regular. We just can't. the best we will do is the kind of peace we can manufacture, which will always, at some point, drift to one or the other extreme. But if we're gonna bring the peace of God into this world and be peacemakers in the way of Jesus, then we have to regularly pursue the Prince of Peace. Like there's a guy that goes to our first service. He's part of Kensington for years, helped build a lot of the sets that you'll see here at times. He built the playground, the playhouse out there for our kids. Like amazing, amazing carpenter. You want this guy to build you a house, he could probably do it in a week. But if you ask him to build you a house and you give him no tools, no supplies, and no resources, then that will never be more than an idea. You'll never get a house out of that. Doesn't matter how talented he is, you're never getting a house out of that without the resources. If we were just told, hey, go be peacemakers, but not given the resource of Jesus, that would never be anything more than an idea. Jesus is our resource to being a peacemaker. This is not something we can just go do if we try harder, if we try to be better, if we try to be nicer. We will fail at that every single time. This requires that we have to stay in deep communion with Jesus. This is why this cannot just be a Sunday morning thing. We come on Sunday, we get our church filled, and then we go home and we think nothing of it until we come back again next week. We have got to be regularly letting God fill up who we are with who he is. Matter of fact, there's a place that for many of you probably is not an unfamiliar set of verses. In the book of Philippians, this is what we read about peace. Apostle Paul says, do not be anxious about anything, but in every situation, by prayer and petition, with thanksgiving, present your requests to God. So he says, listen, you don't have to worry about anything. He said, what I want you to do, I want you to bring the requests you've got and your petitions, the things you need him to do, your frustrations, the things that don't make sense, your thankfulness, like bring it all to him. And what does he do? In response, and the peace of God, which transcends all understanding, will guard your hearts and minds in Christ Jesus. Why do we need our hearts and minds guarded? Because a lack of peace takes our heart and our mind to very dangerous and destructive places. But the presence of God's peace in us, it guards our heart, it guards our mind, and it doesn't make sense. It's literally a peace that does not make sense. That's what he says, it surpasses understanding. And if we can't understand it, then we certainly can't create it. All we can do is receive it and extend it. The peace that surpasses understanding, that's the kind of peace we heard about a few weeks ago when a woman named Michelle stood in the baptism and she shared about her husband who suddenly passed away year and a half earlier, and yet then talked about her pursuit of Jesus and how God has met her and walked her through that. Like, that's a peace that doesn't make sense apart from Jesus. And many of you know that peace. You've experienced it. And for some of you, you're like, I haven't experienced that. And I would wonder, have you sat in his presence enough? Have you gone to the Prince of Peace? Have you done what Paul said? Bring your prayers, bring your frustrations, bring your requests, bring it all before him regularly and sit in his presence. Because he says, if you do that, his promise is, I will invest my peace back into you. A peace that doesn't make sense, that you can't manufacture, you can't create, you can only receive it when you're with me. And when you receive it, you can offer it. First and foremost, if we're gonna be peacemakers, then it requires that we intentionally and regularly are determined to sit in the presence of the Prince of Peace and let him do a work in our own hearts and minds that you cannot manufacture yourself. None of us can. But I do think there are some things that we can do. And I think the second thing that we do, peacemaking, involves choosing an unoffendable response. Choosing an unoffendable response. Remember this one for things I may say later. Choosing an unoffendable response. How much of our conflict in this world is just because we're so easily bent out of shape by everything and everyone? Is anybody else tired of feeling like we have to walk on eggshells all the time? It's like everything you do and everything you say has to be measured. Measured? I don't even know what that is. I'm a pastor, I get to make up words. Measured and weighed and thought through and then rethought through and edited. And listen, there are things that we do say that are dumb and we need to apologize for. There are things that we do that are hurtful and we do need to apologize for. But there is a massive and a constantly growing list of things that we regularly condemn one another for that we just need to let it roll off our back and stop being so easily offended at nearly everything. There's a verse in the Bible. This might be a new one for most of us. John 3:16, I don't know if you ever heard of it. See, because for the follower of Jesus, having an unoffendable response is not just a request, it's an expectation. And before it was an expectation of Jesus to us, it was modeled by Jesus for us. John 3:16, say it. We don't even need it on the screen. You know, I'm tempted to resign right now. That was a little, All right, yeah. For God so loved the world that he gave his one and only son, that whosoever believes in him should not perish but have eternal life. For God so loved the world. If there was ever a situation in all of existence where a being could have been offended, rightfully so, it would be God towards humanity. That verse could have very easily and justifiably been, for God was so offended by us all. For God was so put off by humanity. For God was so irritated at our constant failures and lack of attempts to understand him and pursue him. Like, he could have finished that a whole lot of different ways. God instead chose not to insert offense where offense could have been given. What he chose instead was to insert forgiveness. One of the things my wife and I have used as a phrase for many years is choose to believe the best until you can do so no longer. And I will tell you that the can do so no longer, we make that come a little too soon sometimes. But choose to believe the best. That means that we choose to have a very, 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 very difficult spirit to offend. Instead of what we tend to have in our culture today, which is a spirit that is constantly offended. And when we are constantly offended by one another, here's what we do. When I'm always offended by you, like Patrick, you and I, you just offend me all the time. Your stories and your farming and your come do, your stories offend. What happens is the more I'm offended by Patrick, then the more I take offense and I build offense. The more I take offense at Patrick, the more I build offense between me and Patrick. And fences might be good for backyards and they might be good for keeping you from falling off a cliff. They are not good and they're not healthy for human relationships. And part of what, again, Paul said that the work of Christ has done has destroyed the wall of hostility between us, took the fence down between us. But the more I take offense with you, the more I'm going to build a fence between you and me. But the response of the Christian and the peacekeeper that Jesus would call us to be is that we say we will be some of the most difficult people to offend in this world. Instead of what so often we easily are is some of the easiest people to offend. And I don't mean that just by Christians, I mean that by people. If there is one constant message that I think is unique to our way of life in the Western world is this, be mad and offended at everybody. And as a Christ follower, we need to refuse to buy into that and to succumb to it and instead say, no, as a peacemaker in this world, I will be one of the hardest people to offend. And when I am, we're gonna talk. And we're gonna have a healthy conversation instead of putting a fence up between us. Number three, I think peacemaking also needs to involve evaluating before elevating. Evaluating before elevating. You go back to the Old Testament, David, David's a guy that, you know, he's described as a man after God's own heart, but thankfully, like the rest of us, he's equally jacked up. And at one point, David's getting mad at the people that don't love God the way that he loves God and the way he wants them to love God. And here's his response. If only you, God, would slay the wicked. Away from me, you who are bloodthirsty. They speak of you with evil intent. Your adversaries misuse your name. Do I not hate those who hate you, Lord, and abhor those who are in rebellion against you? I have nothing but hatred for them. Okay, he's kind of elevating here. Now he's getting a little out of, he's irritated. It's escalating very quickly for him. He's like, God, the people don't love you. I hate them. I just smite them. It's like yesterday I was cutting the lawn and my phone starts going off. It's a text thread that starts growing between this longtime group of friends that we've got. Well, they're in this group. We've got one buddy who's total conspiracy theorist. Like everything is conspiracy. And then there's another guy, total opposite of the spectrum. Like he hates every kind of conspiracy. So they constantly are like just getting under each other's skin. So my one buddy, the one that hates conspiracy, he lives in Colorado. And he was like, we were joking about how like they just got 8 inches of snow. So he's like, I'm shoveling snow on the same day that you guys back home are mowing your lawns. He's like, what the heck? And then my conspiracy friend jumps in. He's like, well, the chemtrails and the, he starts going on all this stuff. And so I'm like, I knew it. I knew where this was going. I'm like, oh, this is going to escalate like that. And sure enough, it started to. So I threw in one of the emojis with a dude eating popcorn, like just here for the show. And then I get a call from one guy. He's like, why is you always got to be this way? I'm like, dude, let it go. It doesn't matter. But this is David. Like, he is just escalating very quickly. Like, everybody around him is eating the popcorn going, all right, David, calm down. But here's what's interesting. Here's what he does. He moves from escalating to evaluating. Search me, O God. So he goes, I hate them, I abhor them, they're against you. But then something shifts, and he goes, okay, search me, O God, and know my heart. Test me and know my anxious thoughts. And see if there's any offensive way in me. And then lead me in the way everlasting. I wish maybe if David would have put those in reverse order, he never would have escalated. Maybe if he would have started with evaluating first, it wouldn't have gone to the escalation of all of his anger. And I just wonder, in our own relationships, how much healthier would it be? How much more peace would we create and make in moments at work, in our marriage, in our friendships, at our church? You fill in the blank of where, if we would first do the evaluating work before we let ourselves escalate with irritation. My son, who's been married since June, called me up the other day. He's like, Dad, Bella and I just got in a fight. I was like, good, tell me about it. So he starts telling me all about it and what happened and what she said and what he said. And then he goes, Dad, she just has to understand that she, and I was like, whoa, time out. Did you say that to her? He's like, yeah, why? I was like, and you're still alive? He goes, well, I am in the car out in the parking lot. It's like, okay, so barely. But here's what was good. Like, we were able to have a great conversation. I said, all right, let's do some evaluating. He's like, I didn't do anything wrong. And she, stop with the she. I go, let's evaluate. What did you do? What did you say? And it was so cool because he actually let me walk him through a few moments of evaluation that by the end of it, he's like, I think I need to go home and apologize for a few things. I'm like, yes. I go, that is a foreign experience to me in my marriage because I never get things wrong. But yeah. So I go, yeah, absolutely. It's totally. And he goes, but what about her? I go, stop. You're elevating now. Let God do his work for her right now. And when there's a moment for you guys to have a better conversation, then you can have that better conversation. Right now, all you need to do is evaluate. And let God do that work in your heart. And so later on, I text him like, hey, how's it going? He's like, way better, Dad. Thanks. I was like, cool. You need to listen to me more often. I know what I'm talking about. So like, evaluate before elevate. That's part of what it means to be a peacemaker. Last one I want to give you is one that is going to seem a little contrary to peacemaking. So stay with me for a minute. Part of peacemaking means that we know when to start war to make peace. We know when to start war to make peace. One of my favorite passages in the Old Testament is how God led the nation of Israel out of freedom, of captivity. It's a precursor to the work that he would do in all of our lives through the cross. But in one place in that story, as God leads his people out of captivity, if you know the story, you know this, you have Pharaoh barreling down with his army on Egypt, on Israel, who's pressed up against the Red Sea. They're freaking out. They've got no escape. When Pharaoh gets there, it's not going to be a good scene. So they're crying out. They're worried. This is the scene where moments later the Red Sea is going to part, but it hasn't happened yet. So all they're filled with is fear. And there's a moment where Moses speaks to the people on behalf of God, and he says this. Do not be afraid, but instead stand firm and you will see the deliverance that the Lord will bring on you today. The Egyptians that you see today, you will never see again. The Lord will, would you just say it? Oh, not on the screen. Okay. All right, verse 14, at the end, I want you involved in this. The Lord will what for you? One more time. Not the Lord will go reason with Pharaoh. Not the Lord will go create a better deal with Pharaoh. Not the Lord will go create a contract to get you out. The Lord will fight for you. And we know he did. Because presently at the bottom of the Red Sea is the army of Pharaoh that pursued God's people. The Lord will fight for you. You need only be still. Let me ask you this. Is Jesus, silly question, humor me anyways, is Jesus the perfect example of a peacemaker? He's God. Is he a perfect peacemaker? Okay. If peacemaking is only to be understood as nothing more than only, now it doesn't neglect this, but if it's only gentleness and passivity, then help me understand the God who fights for us. Then how do we understand the Jesus who flipped tables instead of having a rational conversation? Help me understand the God who returns in the book of Revelation with a sword in his hand and not a palm branch to make war against the nations. And please hear me too. Some of you, you're constantly about making war. Some of you, all you want to do is flip tables and pull swords. You probably need counseling and anger management. I did. I grew up in a very angry home. And my response to everything was anger. My response to everything was, it's a battle to fight. And I had to grow up through that. And I still battle that. But I know that that's not God either, to constantly want to fight everything and flip every table. Jesus, we have record of him doing it once. But if we strip that out of who Jesus is and what it means to be a peacemaker, we also miss part of how we become children of God. Amen. Real children of God, living out peacemaking, know when to step into a fight to create peace on the other side. See, when we think of peace, here's what we usually think. When we think peacemaking, these are the kind of images and the emotions that would come from it that come to mind. Not me drinking water, that. Right? I mean, that's, who doesn't want to go there this weekend? Right? But listen, here's the difference. That's peaceful. That's not peacemaking. That's the derivative of peacemaking. That's part of why Revelation tells us that in the end, there's a new order to come where there's no more tear, no more crying, no more death, no more sorrow, no more suffering. That's peaceful. In the meantime, part of what Jesus is about is peacemaking. That's what the cross was. That's why he went to the cross through his shed blood, which was a violent scene. It was not peaceful, but it was peacemaking to battle hell itself, to destroy sin and all of its effects, so that that kind of an eternity is what we're headed for. In the meantime, part of what we are called to in a world wreaked by sin, stripping us of peace, is to be peacemakers. And sometimes that means keeping your mouth closed and listening more than you talk. It means being unoffendable. It means sitting with the Prince of Peace. It means evaluating before escalating, but it also means times that we have to ask, what's the war that I'm called to fight to bring peace where there is no peace? Because let me give you two other pictures. Here's one. This is a picture, while it has nothing peaceful about it, it is peacemaking. These are African soldiers freeing children from human trafficking. That's peacemaking. Now, I want to give you one more in just a second, but this one may create a buzz for you, and it may frustrate you a little bit. I'm not promoting violence, I'm not promoting war, but I want you to understand that there should be a disruption that we feel when we sit in the idea of what true peacemaking is in the presence of evil and violence and the lack of peace. Here's another one. This guy's name is Jay Johnson. He's a former British officer who, after finishing his time in the military, has dedicated his life to freeing children who have been kidnapped and sold into slavery. He leads a small team around the world where in 12 different countries, he has rescued hundreds of children now. There is nothing peaceful about that picture, but it is peacemaking in the presence and in the midst of violence and evil and wickedness. You go, well, that picture just looked more like war and violence to me. No, human war and human violence is always about two things: personal gain, personal reward. Peacemaking like that is about gain and reward for other people, not yourself. Which is why, listen, why true peacemakers in the form of Jesus usually personally lose, just like he did. The book of Isaiah tells us what God's work would be in this world and how he would get it done. He grew up before him like a tender shoot and like a root out of dry ground. He had no beauty or majesty to attract us to him, and nothing in his appearance that we should desire him. He was despised, and he was rejected by mankind. He was a man of suffering and familiar with pain, like one from whom people hide their faces. He was despised, and we held him in low esteem. But surely he took our pain, and he bore our suffering, and yet we considered him punished by God, stricken by him and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions, and he was crushed for our iniquities. Listen, and the punishment that brought us peace was on him. There is nothing peaceful about that scene. This is a reference to the cross he would endure, one of the most horrifically violent scenes that you could ever go through to be killed. There's nothing peaceful about it, but it was peacemaking to our benefit and to his loss.
Thanks for joining us for this audio cast. We hope it encouraged you. Kensington Church is one church with multiple locations in the beautiful state of Michigan. Learn more about our audio offerings by visiting kensingtonchurch.org/listen and watch services on our YouTube channel.